Welcome to the Europeans on the Vote podcast, a podcast on political participation brought to you by ECAS, the European Citizen Action Service. Hello, my name is Marta Silva. I'm the communication manager at ECAS, the European Citizen Action Service, and I'm your host for today. In this episode, we're going to talk about e-democracy, also known as digital democracy. And with me, I have Dr. Giovanni Allegretti, planner and senior researcher at Coimbra University in Portugal, with vast experience as a trainer, consultant, and evaluator of participatory processes in over 50 countries. And Dr. Gianluca Sgueo, faculty member at Sciences Po, where he teaches digital democracy and public spaces. His professional background includes multiple experience, such as working at the European Parliament and for the Italian government. First of all, welcome, bienvenuti. It is an honor to have you with us today. And to start, Gianluca, could you explain to our listeners what is digital democracy?
Yes. First of all, thank you very much for having me here. It's a pleasure. And it's a quite fascinating topic. We've been talking and we've been analyzing and discussing about the interplay between democracy at large, so participatory democracy, electoral democracy, and the use of technology. And we started a few years ago with, there was a momentum in which we were thinking that the use of digital technology would spread democratic values all across the world so that people will participate more. Young voters will go back to voting and people will be more engaged. I still clearly remember I was teaching back then and I were using as a case study the Arab Springs, these protests that were happening in the north of Africa in different countries. And the narration was all around the use of social media. Twitter in particular has the fuel of people protesting. So back then the idea was the digitalization of the public power is going to make this public power more participated, transparent, accountable, and so on. We are now in a phase in which we still rely and we increasingly rely on technologies and, for example, artificial intelligence. So there are a lot of benefits that we can have. However, I would say that some of the issues in terms of misrepresentation or lack of interest or lack of trust or misinformation have not been solved yet by the use of digital technology in democracy. So it's quite an interesting moment in which you see how the two systems are evolving along and creating new opportunities and at the same time, a few challenges.
Okay, thank you. I think it was a very complete answer. And the next one, it's a more personal curiosity. Have you ever used a voting machine or voted online? And if you have seen any developments in voting facilities in your countries or host countries since you started voting?
Okay, I have an experience, but it's related to many different types of participatory democracy, not with representative systems. For example, when I lived in Rome, I used some polling machines that were created by the Lazio region. And in order to vote with the national health card, at the same time, in the local participatory budgeting and in the regional experience of participatory budgeting. So the idea was not to create a burden for citizens and create a system that could make fluid and fast voting and participatory processes. Actually, I have been voting them in several participatory budgeting in my cities in Portugal, for example, in Lisbon and Coimbra, was always online with different form of authentication. And in Lisbon, actually, there were some bugs because I could vote online. At the same time, I could vote offline and in a sort of bus of participatory budgeting, a caravan equipped with computers, and the system were not communicating, so I voted three times. It was not forbidden. I didn't know anything illegal, but I want to test how much the security can also grant credibility and legitimacy of a system. And in reality, there were critics to the possibility that people could vote several times in the process. Then I voted in the national participatory budgeting. I still was not a Portuguese citizen at the time. So I had to do a mobile key that was created especially for foreigners to vote in the national participatory budgeting.
Well, my experience is not as rich as the one of Giovanni, but I recall very, very clearly, it was early 2000s and I was in Italy, and back then we had a round of referendum votes, so on large topics on which many people were asked, all the Italians, like in the national elections. And the Italian government back then ran an experiment with some electronic voting, and I was one of those volunteers who were working on that. It was an experiment, so it was done aside the traditional voting. The way it went, I would say, was pretty smooth. And I will also say that the results by the end of the voting were pretty good. But as far as I know, that was the only experiment. So after then, in the Italian government, at the national level, we didn't have equal attempts to have a digitalized vote.
And I think we see this in a lot of countries, that they start piloting e-voting and then they stop. I'm a bit jealous because I never voted online or with a voting machine. But if I was Estonian, probably I have already used a voting machine or voted online. And this leads to my next question. When we talk about e-voting, of course, we must speak about Estonia, pioneer country in digital governance and the first country in the world to implement e-voting in a nationwide election almost 20 years ago. Gianluca, why do you think other countries are still reluctant to use this method?
Well, there are a number of reasons to me. One is the dimension. We all look at the example of Estonia as best practice, and it actually is, it works. But the dimension of the country as Estonia is, in terms of inhabitants and cities, is probably a little less than a large city in other European countries. When you think how you want to escalate the benefits of an e-voting system, you also have to take care of the dimension of the citizens that could be involved. And so you have a larger number of citizens that are unqualified to use digital tools properly. And you have parts of the country, I'm thinking about Italy, that are still not reached by high-speed broadband connection, which means that they will have to move to another place. I'm touching something that which I'm sure Giovanni is sensitive, but we just had the regional elections in Sardinia that were run in a traditional way. And after 10 days, I think, they are still counting the votes. So you see, we are pretty much lagging behind in terms of traditional structures before thinking of how to implement a digital infrastructure that will make the vote working. So if I have to summarize my answer, I would say one is the level of population that you want to engage. The second one is the creation, and so the lags in the infrastructure that will make a digitalized vote possible for the entire population of a country.
Thank you, Giovanni. You want to add something?
I would like to add something that is related to the level of risks that the different type of election have. For example, in some countries like Switzerland, France, there have been experiments which were not in a safe environment, but were in a safe political environment because they were voting about small things. Now, in Ontario, there are several municipalities that vote by internet. In France, they voted for several years. There is a council of French people abroad. So it was something that was not so dangerous if it was boycotted by a foreign malicious actor. So sometimes the attempts are done on something. For example, Switzerland made its foreign citizens vote by internet, but not the majority of citizens that were concentrated in the country. In Australia, the military missions abroad used internet for voting within a safe platform of the Ministry of Defense. So, you know, you try to take your own measures in order to avoid the higher risks. It's important to acknowledge that, because also the level of concern that different countries in the geopolitical world system have is different. I mean, you don't have international threats to Portugal election like you can have in Poland or in Italy, for example, no? So,
also a question of dimension of the countries.
A question of dimension and also a question of geopolitical placement. Mm-hmm. Where are you are you close to some countries that can be more interested in boycotting your election or not?
So you touch upon some challenges like security, and we'll talk a little bit later on this. Besides security and privacy, it also presents unique challenges to individuals with low digital literacy. Gianluca, what principles should be considered when designing e-voting interfaces to cater to low literacy voters?
So first of all, yes, I would say that the human factor is, in spite of we're talking of technology, but it still remains the most important factor. So the literacy of people, how people are using technology meaningfully and securely, it's absolutely crucial. I would say that in terms of the design of the typical tool that can be used for voting in an electronic way, it's not particularly complex. I mean, it can be designed in a very simple fashion. It's more about educating people on the understanding of the process that is digitalized and about the values that are behind democracy. So I'm not escaping your question. I'm actually making another point. I would say that the problem of digital literacy of people, it's a very problem, and it affects all the way that people interact with a state that is digitalized beyond elections. And that means that when you think about how you want to tackle digital literacy into e-voting, you are not necessarily going to look, in my opinion, to how to design the voting machine. Because again, I think it's quite a simple design. You have to work on what are the values that people put into a vote that is either digitalized or analogic. So it's a background exercise or struggle that countries have in order to bring people to e-voting. Yes, you can sell the idea that e-voting is simpler, but actually it's not the pushing, the clicking on a button and saying, yes, I vote this candidate or I don't like this candidate. It's more convincing the Gianluca or Giovanni why it's worth that you spend your time and you go to a polling place, or you connect from your home and you identify yourself and you vote. And you see, these type of design are not the design of the proper voting action, but are the design of the democratic interactions.
We are here focusing a lot about the challenges, but I think it's important to mention that e-voting is essential when considering, for example, the rights of people with reduced mobility. So we focus a lot in the challenges, but of course the benefits are much higher. So Giovanni, we've talked a bit on the challenges of digital democracy, one of them being security. With technologies presenting opportunities for malicious actors to undermine elections, what steps can be taken to safeguard elections in this connected world that we live in?
First of all, we have to remember something, that even within Europe, the responsibility for election, it's by the central states. So it's not related to the European Union. So standardization is very difficult. What is easier is to try to imagine best practice that can be replicated in different countries, but different countries consider themselves targets of malicious phenomena in a different way, which is related to their geopolitical importance or to their size, for example. I think that cross-fertilization among best practice is the only way to go ahead in this type of topic. Also because we are thinking always about the technological aspect, but the majority of the problems happen during the campaigns. So they are not related to the voting act, but they are related to all the preparation of the voting. So, for example, I think that some countries, like some states in the United States or some area in Switzerland, where there is a wonderful project called DemoScan that works on sort of citizen initiative reviews. That means that panels of citizens deliberate about a referendum before, so they discuss the pro and con of each position, and they produce a very small document that try to orient their fellow citizens in the jungle. And for example, the results in Switzerland say that in the DemoScan project, the person interviewed about this final document of this panel said that it increased 20% their will to vote, because it clarifies issues that in the jungle of communication disappear. Because we know that communication can be the way to reward the strongest actor. Let's think about the referendum that was done in the United States 2 years ago about Uber. Uber paid $200 million of publicity and they won the referendum with 58% of people saying that Uber drivers were not traditional workers and they could not have the rights of the workers of any other enterprise. And that's why, because someone invested money in that. So we have to work a lot on behavior. Micro-targeting, for example, today is a very dangerous practice that was born in the commercial environment, but is used in politics and that must be stopped. So there are, for example, in 2 years ago in the Netherlands, there was a sort of conduct code signed by parties, by platform, by candidates, in order to reduce this type of practice that's sometimes can be attracting for the candidates themselves, no? Because they come from a commercial perspective on, but citizens are not buyers. They are a little bit different in that moment. So I think that we have to take into account all this line. Cheating exists, yes. There are also ways to tackle it. For example, in participatory democracy, where the fact of having malicious powers that enter the internet is less concerning, because we are talking about decision on a small scale for small amounts of money, there are good practice, like, for example, creating a commission that can deal with this type of issues. For example, in Portugal, in Guimarães, in Condeixa, in other cities, also in Italy, in Tuscany, there have been cheating on the internet while voting for participatory budgeting. But there were commissions created by the mayor with citizens also inside that could take decision on if it was necessary to cancel the voting and restart it, or we could just penalize the priority that was being voted with using cheating or not. So it's very important to have other offline elements that can accompany all this process in this complexity and in this different stages that goes from the construction of the campaign, the discussion on ideas, to the moment of voting. And let's remember that the moment of voting, the most problematic issue underlined by dozens of commissions that did not allow many countries to use internet because they discouraged them to use it, are referred, even in Estonia, there is a polemics on this, to the transmission of data after the election. It's not during the voting the problem. It's when you send voting to centrals that count voting that the problem can happen. So there is an ecosystem that has to be analyzed, and you have to take care of every stage in order to avoid this kind of problems.
It's a layer approach, and I think you mentioned something quite interesting, that one solution fits all. It's really not appropriate, as each country has their own particularities. What about data privacy? So how can we ensure that e-voting is safe and fully respects privacy, Giovanni?
Okay, if you analyze the system of Estonia, for example, you can discover that the number of data that are needed are very reduced and very well encrypted, for example, in order to avoid this problem. So normally in the electoral process, the data privacy is not the most important problem you have. But in participatory democracy, for example, it is. Because participatory democracy need to study what is the main difference. You don't change a lot from one year to the other electoral systems. In Estonia, the system is almost all the same, a little bit more safe, but it's the same system of voting. But in participatory democracy, you change everything. You change the way in which you vote, the number of votes you can cast. The processes of participation need to evolve together with their participants. So they need to be incrementally changing. And for that, you have to study what things are working and what are not. And the problem is that to study these things, you need to cross the data of voting with more important data that are the profile of people. So you need a sort of profiling, which have to be granted as anonymous. Now, I can tell you that the GDPR in Europe in 2016 and the laws that were created by the countries later was really a moment of change. Many municipalities today are very scared by the responsibility given by GDPR, and so they do not study anymore on their processes, and this is reducing the quality of all the participatory system of many cities because of the fear of GDPR. So the only solution is to ask people to be part of a democratic experiment, okay?
To ask for consent.
Yes, to consent it. Explaining that evolution of the system is in their interest, is in the interest of democracy. But sometimes you have to continue to guarantee anonymity, for example. There is a wonderful book by Hans Eisenbaum that was recently published by Oxford University Press. It's called Politics of Becoming, and the subtitle is Anonymity and Democracy in the Digital Age. It's a study about how much anonymity in a period of political mistrust is necessary, not useful, necessary to make people start a process of gradual construction of trust in the institution. And sometimes the things are very sensitive. For example, Greenland is a country still in a very colonial system in relation to Denmark. And so when the electronic system are powered by Danish enterprises, Greenlandic people, they do not want to use them because they are scared to be filed by their conqueror. And so it's better to use a foreigner enterprise of another country than a Danish enterprise. So sometimes things are very, very culturally oriented. So you have to take care of this hypersensitivity of people when we are talking about democracy.
So you're saying the context is quite important also when considering data requirements.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. In Portugal, I have problem with elderly people to ask any type of question because they were still scared of the secret police of the dictatorship that ended 50 years ago. But elderly people are still scared by it. So you cannot ask question, personal question to them. Democracy is sensitive, is about people. You have to know that you cannot standardize even technology. And that's why co-design could be the good practice for the future.
This co-deciding shows how you can empower citizens at a local level. Now changing to another subject, you are both part of ProDemo, a research project funded by the EU on promoting democratic engagement through mobile participation. Could you explain to our listeners what is this project and its impact on fostering political participation and engagement with EU mobile citizens?
So the starting point was we have in Europe, if I remember correctly, around 15 million mobile citizens. These are people like, I would say, pretty much me and Giovanni. So we are nationals of Italian nationals, but we both moved to other countries to work and we reside and work permanently in another country. Now, what is our engagement with the political system, so the democratic system of the countries that are hosting us? Well, in the case of Giovanni, it's now a second nationality, but in my case, I'm still only national. I still only have the nationality of Italy. So what is my engagement with France or even Belgium, where I've been living for a little while? And I would say the problem is most of the mobile citizens, in spite of living for a long time in another country, so benefiting from that country, are never become engaged with the politics of their country. They were perhaps engaged with their country. They are sometimes still going to vote in their national original country, but they never get engaged in a country. Even a country like Belgium that is extremely favorable to giving voting rights to the expats. And so this is the background. The idea was, can we design a mobile application that will centralize a number of options that go from informing people, giving people access to communication with politicians, and eventually even giving them the chance to interact with politicians? Can we design this up and make with this an extra mile in helping the mobile citizens to be more engaged? Well, the app has been designed. I wouldn't say it has necessarily changed the condition of mobile citizens, but the idea behind it was, let's have a beneficial use, since you mentioned benefits, I agree with you, let's have a beneficial use of digital technology for a very concrete problem that we still have in Europe.
So now to finish in a more philosophical way, Gianluca, how do you envision the future of digital democracy? This is a big question.
Big question indeed. There's many possible answers to this question. I will give you one perspective. Actually, the last book that I published, in which I start with this question, the title of the book is The Design of Digital Democracy. And I think that our future is shaped by the way that we will design our interactions with a digitalized democracy. Let me give you just a very few details. The way that we interact with modern technologies is based on a very few principles. One is the velocity of service. So you want to have the service, the product that you are buying, delivered as soon as possible. And we expect our digital technology to give us a very simplified interaction. So it's foolproof technology. And to some extent, it's also an individual interaction. When I go on Google Maps, Google Maps tell me exactly the route that it suits for me, not for everyone. When I go on any food delivery app, it tells me, according to what you have done before, this is the best food for you. And the same goes for streaming platforms. The algorithm tells you, this is good for you. So it's an individualized experience. All this gratification is what brings digital technology to us. Now, my point is that the design of digital technology can't be based on these small and constant gratifications, because democracy is complex, democracy is made of struggles, and even in a digitalized democracy, in e-voting, this was the point that I was trying to make during the entire interview, we should never forget that it still remains a complex process, and this complexity is the reason why democracy exists. We need to talk with each other, we need to have different opinions, we need time, we need a longer process. So a good future of a digital democracy is the one in which we will deal with digital technologies applies to democracy in a way that makes us understanding the complexity of the interactions in spite of the simplicity of the platform. A dystopic future is one in which we will not be gratified by a digitalized state because we expect from that state the same interactions and gratification that we have from commercial technologies. And this is not possible.
Well, I think we can conclude that the digital democracy has a bright future ahead. I prefer to believe than a dystopic one, and that civic engagement will increasingly take place online as digital democracy is really transforming decision-making. Thank you so much both for being here. It was a great pleasure. I learned so much, and I'm sure our listeners also. Thank you. For our listeners, see you soon and check the description so you don't miss the upcoming episode. Bye-bye.